Real quick before we start, I wanted to remind you that the Kickstarter campaign for The Lost Bay RPG is live and we've been burning through stretch goals. The Lost Bay RPG is a suburban gothic game set in 1990X, where you play white characters who have been touched by the weird and mysterious force and who have acquired powers and are fighting evil creatures and beasts and cults and secrets. The Lost Bay RPG is a set of two hardback books, The Lost Bay, which is the core book containing the rules, a bestiary, an implied setting, pre-generated point crawls, procedures for exploration, and much more. We're talking about around 160 pages of core book. The second book, called Urban Legend, is a collection of adventures by guest designers and also a campaign framework to run a West Marshes-like campaign in 1990X suburbia. The Lost Bay RPG is live on Kickstarter. I'll put the link in the show notes, or you could just go to thelostbayrpg.com. Again, that's thelostbayrpg.com. You're listening to The Lost Bay Podcast, a show about and with indie tabletop RPG creators and artists. I'm Iko. Today my guest is Chris McDowell, designer of several games actually, Into the Odd, Electric Bastionland, and his latest game, Mythic Bastionland. If you're into indie games, you're probably familiar with at least one of those three titles. The three games share variations of the same core game system that was introduced with Into the Odd. D20, simple, fast, deadly, lightweight. A game system that has been quite influential in the indie scene. Mythic Bastionland is Chris's latest game. It's been successfully funded on Kickstarter at the end of last year. It's a medieval fantasy game kind of set in the mythical past of the Electric Bastionland setting. It's a game about knights, seers, glory, legends, and myths. So Chris, welcome back to the Lost Bay Podcast. I'm super excited to have you back. That's been 3 years since we spoke last time. And feels like it was a few months ago, but no, that was 3 years. A lot has happened. You've released several titles. And today I'd like to focus mainly on your latest game, Mythic Bastionland. But one thing that strikes me is that your trifecta, Into the Odd, Electric Bastionland, and Mythic Bastionland, forms kind of a continuum. The games feel linked either thematically or from a design standpoint. I'm curious to know, how are they connected to each other? How are they linked?
I wanted them to be connected, not so much for the obvious reason, which is you can have your character from Electric Bastionland go out into the world of Mythic Bastionland or go into a game of Into the Odd, and you can kind of make it work usually. There's like a few little fine-tuning things between the systems that require a little bit of tweaking, and there's like a little guide at the back of Mythic Bastionland for how to do that. But really, I kind of found a style of play that I really enjoyed, and I thought really encapsulated how I like to play games. And it seemed like there were lots of other people that felt the same way. So for me, it goes beyond just being like a connected setting. It's also like the rules are so similar. And even when they're different, it's coming from the same philosophy of how a game plays, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you've written extensively on the core principles of the gameplay philosophy you like, but for people who might not be familiar with your work, what's the core of the gameplay style or philosophy you enjoy and you like to design as well?
With Into the Odd, it was all about trying to make rules that get out of the way. Mm-hmm. Because that is a game essentially about going down into a dungeon, try and find treasure and weird magic items and trying not to get killed by these horrible monsters. And there's lots of games that do that. But I wanted to see how far I could strip back the rules and still have that type of game work. And with Electric Bastionland, it was kind of the same, where I thought, well, I like this idea of these campaigns based around a big city and having all this kind of intrigue and stuff going on and urban adventure. But I wanted to see how much I could pull the rules back so that all that weird city stuff kind of comes through, even if the rules themselves are very straightforward. And with Mythic Bastion, and even though Mythic is kind of the, it's got the most rules probably of the three, it's still trying to encapsulate something very big, this idea of a mythic, you know, Pendragon style generational campaign with domain management and warfare and, you know, huge realms that you're kind of exploring. I wanted to see if I could still capture all that with as few rules, but not too few. That's the key. that's the balance that's hard to find. The phrase that I keep using is rules light, flavor heavy. So minimal rules, but lots of stuff that you actually need at the table to make the game fun and exciting.
Yeah, I think like you've 100% hit that from the preview that's available in PDF of Mythic Bastion. And what strikes me is that the rule part looks much longer than your previous games, but so much shorter than any other games out there or than lots of games out there. And listen, there's that kind of shared core rule set and gaming experience, but there's another layer that kind of connects the three games, is that odd, weird, almost hallucinated atmosphere.
Yeah. It's the thing that appeals to me about RPGs, is it's always been this thing where, especially when I was growing up and you had, you know, video games were very limited in what they could do with their graphics and how much content they could really have. So it was kind of harder for me to feel like video games were ever showing me anything especially weird, even though there were games that had that. I feel like words were so much more powerful then. If you describe a monster or a place, it's very different than seeing the place for real or watching a film where you're seeing a location. It's always going to be slightly odd. It's always going to be slightly dreamlike because you're essentially trying to kind of dream that place into reality yourself.
Yeah.
So I like to kind of lean into that kind of strangeness.
And your writing style is very specific, very concise, and extremely flavorful. And aside from RPGs, are you also like influenced by literature or something else? Are you a reader?
I'm good at reading. I'm not good at finishing. I can start reading a book a lot, and I love reading nonfiction books and like reference books and things that aren't a book that you have to read from cover to cover. Yeah. Something about the way my brain works really struggles to get through a novel that you have to start at the beginning and work your way through. I really have to push myself to do it. For Mythic Bastion, for instance, I did read some sort of Arthurian literature around that and dipped in and out. Le Morte d'Arthur, I did not make it all the way through that. I will confess that now. But I had lots of books about mythology, like encyclopedia style books. And there's a book series called The Enchanted World that were released by Time Life Publishing in the 90s, I think. And I managed to get a load of them secondhand. Each book will be about a different thing. So one book is about dragons and one was about giants. It was a subscription service back in the day. Right. They've got so much fantastic artwork and short stories all the way through. So I drew on those a lot because the myths that kind of make up the content of Mythic Bastion Land are, by their nature, almost like short stories or short story prompts, I guess, rather than a sort of start to finish story. It was good to tap into those sorts of books more than the kind of long form books that I really struggle with.
So I imagine you having like a pile of books and you were reading several of them at the same time.
Yeah, I need to focus more. But the good thing is you end up with a sort of cocktail of influences that kind of mixes together and hopefully turns into something that represents you as a writer.
And listen, what are other influences for Mythic Bastion Land, like in the RPG world, the kind of obvious question is Pendragon like in some way an influence to the game or not?
With Electric Bastion Land and Into the Odd, with both of those games, there are kind of magical and occult things in there, but there's not your kind of traditional D&D magic where there's wizards and overtly magical creatures. It's a bit more kind of alien and science. Yeah. So I thought, well, if I do like a sort of medieval version, I could go more into the kind of the British folklore version of magic and kind of go into that. And that kind of led me into looking at Pendragon and things like that. And I'd always been aware of Pendragon, but first of all, I don't have enough players who would be willing to sit down for a multi-year long campaign. And I don't think I would really want to run a multi-year long campaign. I really love the idea, you know, the great Pendragon campaign where you're working your way through every session is a year and you kind of, your character ages and has children and then dies. But it just wasn't realistic for what I wanted to do. So I have played a bit of Pendragon, but I'm working more off my dream version of it rather than the reality of it. So yeah, it's definitely been an influence, but I'm trying to capture the kind of the idealistic version where you can play a long form campaign that perhaps only takes a few weeks, or maybe you even squeeze it into one session where you have a generational play happening across a single night.
Yeah, and about that, I can see like you've retained the idea of Pendragon, but crushed it and reduced its size. And also time in Pendragon is very linear, whereas Bashanan, you could play through seasons and through years and have your character age. But the way this happens, I don't know, it's a bit evanescent. It's not linear. Do you want to talk about how you've built that?
Yeah, so I deliberately wanted to keep it vague because I didn't really want players to be worrying too much about how many weeks have passed, how many months have passed. When it comes to time, I decided to just have these time jumps. Yeah. So if it was harvest season when we played this week, it'll be winter next week, and then it'll be spring the following week. That just means that you're getting these kind of snapshots of the characters' lives as they go through their kind of story. In the same way, when you read some of these Arthurian myth books, some of them do stick around the same in quite a linear way, but some of them do jump around quite suddenly. So I wanted to capture some of that in the kind of the time jumps. And as well as jumping ahead in seasons, you can decide to jump ahead an age. So rather than tracking individual years of how old your character is, they're just either young, mature, or old. And you can tell that I'm putting myself in that mature category because that's when you reach your peak, according to this game. Whereas in Pendragon, I was incredibly upset to realize that from the age of 38, I think that's when you start going downhill.
Oh, yeah, really?
And I turned 38 last year when I was writing this. So this was my way of saying maybe in this version, the mature knight is kind of at their peak.
Second that vision. Totally makes sense. And that's a really cool feature to give players the possibility to have their characters like jump forward in age in a very like radical way. And you mentioned that knights are kind of your own interpretation of classical Arthurian knight archetypes, and the other core character of the game are the seers. Can you tell us who they are and what's their role in terms of gameplay and the world building, basically?
Yeah, originally, when I was looking at writing a game that was kind of going to be inspired by a sort of medieval kind of era, it's if you're going to have knights and you're going to be set in a medieval Europe kind of thing, you need something that's going to sit in the place of the church. Mm-hmm. I thought, what if there were these types of characters who were kind of these weird, almost alien creatures, but sort of really ramp the weirdness up, and they operate exactly like the church. There's just a dominant religion, and this is who they are. Some are just your kind of slightly strange, weird person who can see the future, but they've all got a twist.
Yeah.
There's often like a physical thing that's just like making them weird. So they might be this huge, immovable, like mass of limbs. They might be almost like a ghost. They might be trapped inside a metal coffin. They might be at the bottom of a lake, but they can all see the past and the future and the present in some form. So they're incredibly powerful and incredibly useful to have in an RPG where you're trying to go around essentially solving problems because they know the answers. But the downside is that you've got to go and then deal with this alien creature with their kind of alien agenda as well. They all have something they want. The first encounter with a seer is always really memorable. Yeah. And whenever they encounter a new seer, it's interesting seeing the players kind of work out, how can we respectfully deal with this weird creature who we're meant to honor because we're knights? And we want to get the information from them, but how can we avoid just becoming their kind of lackey?
And the knight's destiny is tied to the seers. And like in terms of game, in the like preview PDF, there's 72 available knights. They're like backgrounds available. And each knight has their own seer, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. So you don't necessarily have to use that seer for that knight in the game. And it's kind of mentioned that if you had this knight, you were knighted by this particular seer. That's a nice way of kind of introducing this element to the players. The way that I've laid it out is that on each spread, you've got a knight, a seer, and one of the myths. Yeah. But I really like being able to open the book to a two-page spread as a referee, and you know that you've got a knight and a seer and a myth all ready to go. And you almost can't help but try and piece them together into a story.
That's a very clever design and layout choice. And listen, so you've been reading books on Arthurian legends. Are you like inspired by historical figures or legendary figures, variations of knights from history or literature?
Yeah, I tried not to make it too much of like a one-to-one reference. I wanted this to be the myth of Bastionland. It's not British myth, even though there's inspiration from it. I tried to avoid having one where, say, oh, you look at a knight and you're like, oh, this is Lancelot. So I tried to just spread those things out. I tried to sort of chop them down into their pieces and spread those pieces among a few characters. And so that nothing quite feels like it's sort of a direct one-to-one.
Are there any knights you're particularly fond of?
The one that sticks with me, because I feel like it still captures some of that playfulness of characters that you get from Electric Bastionland, is a character called the Coin Knight. And the Coin Knight, their special ability is that instead of attacking as normal, they can just flip a coin. And if it's heads, they kill whatever they're trying to kill. And if it's tails, they're killed immediately. And like, there's no way back. And I'm not saying this is the cleverest mechanic ever, but it feels like it still captures some of that kind of playfulness of Electric Bastionland, where you can still have those moments of levity, a little bit of comedy in there, and a little bit of absurdity in there. It doesn't have to be super serious just because it's based on this myth that takes itself quite
seriously. That's super fun, by the way. And generally speaking, I find that all the knights kind of embody that sort of duality. You've got the archetype of the knight that is chasing glory, but they have some kind of, I don't know, like weird vulnerabilities that you could use to play them either in a more serious way or in a more funny way. Like, there's a lot of nuance in them.
Yeah, and that comes down to the passions. Every knight has a passion. And mechanically, that's used to restore one of your ability scores. So if your spirit gets drained, you can indulge your passion in order to bring it back. So your passion might be something like sleeping underground in the dark, because they sort of come up through these caves underground. So even if you never really have to indulge your passion to restore your ability, I found that players really like having that in there. That knight who loves sleeping in caves, they're going to make them act like they don't like the sunlight or they're a bit antisocial or strange. So just having it there as a prompt is really cool, and it helps make them feel different. Because when you've got every character is a knight, there is the risk that people don't feel like their character is distinctive from the group. So I really wanted to make sure they all had those little bits of personality in there too.
Yeah, that's such a great design feature. Okay, I like to get back to myths. Every myth contains locations, moods, characters. They have a great balance because they offer so many gaming opportunities. There's a lot of depth in each of them, but they just fit in one page, which is quite extraordinary, frankly. I was wondering, how did you frame what was needed to build a myth in terms of design and gameplay? How did you end up with that list of things that builds a myth in one page?
Well, I knew that I wanted to have tools that helped GMs prepare for their game without it feeling like it was this huge task, like you have to prepare this giant hex map and you have to come up with something for every hexagon that's interesting. Instead, I wanted to have it kind of almost just work by itself. So the idea came to have these myths that are sort of scattered around. So there might be six scattered around your realm. And when the players travel, there's a chance that they'll get an encounter. And that encounter is usually going to be with the nearest myth, the one that they're closest to, but it could also be from another myth in the realm. And when you go to that myth, you'll have six omens that will sort of happen in order. So the first time you encounter the myth of the troll, for instance, you might get something that's kind of unrelated. Like, you might just find like a hut that's been smashed up by some creature and it's been abandoned. And then the second time you encounter the troll, you'll get the second omen, which might be you find like a weirdly rubbery limb clawing itself across the ground. And they sort of escalate until by the time you get to six, it's usually some big climactic thing involving that creature or location or the event that the myth is based around. And you're right, it was really challenging to write six prompts that could only really be a couple of lines or three or four lines of text. It's tricky to get those to work, write them in an evocative enough way, but still gave the GM enough to run an encounter. It usually give enough to kind of spark the encounter. But I also have like a list of the cast of that myth. So for the troll, there might be the troll itself. But then I'll also have like stat blocks for the other things that can be encountered as part of that myth. And you can do a lot of work in there as well. So if I describe the troll's behavior and its drives in an interesting way, then the GM will know how to make an encounter with the troll interesting because they know that it's driven by these particular things. It was a real challenge. It's worked really well for myself, and I've heard good things so far from players. I want the referee to be able to almost have the world run itself and almost be surprised along with the players as these things kind of emerge.
Just to quickly break down what's on the myth page. So there's the title, a very short poetic description, illustration that kind of sets the tone and also really helps to read the text that's on the other half of the page. There's the omens, there's the casts with a series of NPCs. Each myth has its own table with things you can roll that are meaningful. And at the bottom of the page, there's that very cool thing where you have a dwelling, a sanctum, a monument, a hazard, a curse, and a ruin. Like a quick list of sparks that you can use like to give you even more depth or to push like the fiction forward or the adventure forward in a different direction. And that's really cool.
Yeah. And again, I lean into that sort of improvisation style a lot myself. And I think just having those little prompts for, I mean, it sounds like such a basic thing, but I'm always surprised how many games don't come with a list of names.
Yeah.
The amount of times I've run a game at the table and the worst thing you have to do is think of a name off the top of your head for an NPC the players have just encountered. I just try to think of, well, other than name, what are the other things that you might need? So like you say, you get like a characteristic. So what makes this NPC memorable and just an object and I need an animal. All those things are all scattered across the bottom.
And listen, you've mentioned a few times your own playing experience of Mythic Bastionland. Do you play a lot? Do you run a lot of games or play? Or I don't know, maybe you even play your own games as a player.
I very rarely get to play my own games. In the last couple of years in writing Mythic Bastionland, I've tried to play it as much as possible. It's now kind of finished. It's interesting going back and seeing how it's changed over all those different playtests. I've played it a couple of times this year already, and I've got a couple of games lined up, but I'm trying to now indulge in the luxury of playing other people's games just for a short amount of time until I've got something else to test. It's nice to take a break from that because over the last couple of years, this has been my main focus to get to the table.
Yeah, I imagine that. Into the Odd, Electric Bastionland, Mythic Bastionland belong to a same family of games. And combat rules in Mythic Bastionland remain simple and fast and deadly, like in the other two games, but they add a certain tactical flavor, but not too crunchy tactical, but still with a lot of narrative depth, and particularly with feats. Can you explain what feats are and how you designed that?
Yeah, so I had the luxury here where every character was going to be some sort of knight. They are all martial characters to an extent, and they should feel that way rather than Electric Bastionland, where you might be a postman, essentially, or like just some random people who have random jobs. But here, because I had that luxury, I thought, well, this is a chance to experiment a little bit with having those things. So I ended up having these three feats that are sort of tied to your three ability scores. It gives your knight a bit more flavor in that if you've got a knight with a very high vigor score, you know they're very good at using the smite feat. And if you have a knight who has a high spirit score, they're very good at using the deny feat. It gives you just a little extra button to press. But because it's the same three buttons for everyone, it's not like everyone now has this character sheet of all these unique special combat buttons that they have to worry about and have to memorize. Instead, it's just this one extra thing that I usually don't even explain it until combat starts when I'm playing with players for the first time. And they all kind of work the same way. So it just adds in that extra bit of making characters feel like they know what they're doing. They can swing a sword, basically. They're not the losers of Electric Bastionland necessarily, but the world still feels dangerous and combat still feels fast.
It's a really cool feature. And by the way, am I correct? Some NPCs, if there are knights, can have those feats, right, as well?
Yeah, anybody that's called a knight has those three feats. There are a few characters in there that might have one feat. So if somebody isn't a knight, but they're a particularly strong warrior, they might have the smite feat. I think there's like a hunter who has a smite feat that they can use with their bow. It lets you have a few of those little combat tricks in there without overcomplicating things.
That's cool. That's really cool. And would you like to talk about like the development process? You've been working on this game for a couple of years, and I would like to ask you what was one of the most critical changes or transformation in the book since its inception?
Well, the first playtest that I put out was July 2022. Okay. So I guess nearly 2 years now. And the thing that I was really drawn to was the kind of magic, the kind of the fairy tale magic that you hear about. One of the first blog posts I wrote about it was this idea of really enjoying monsters that have these like fairy tale rules. So vampires are the classic example. There's all these rules about vampires, that like they can't come in if you don't invite them. Yeah. They can't go out in daylight. They can't cross over streams and running water and all this stuff. And in very freeform games like tabletop RPGs, those are really fun. So the very sort of start of the project, I was focusing on how do I make these mythic feeling monsters all feel like unique magical things. So like rather than there being goblins in this world, there is the goblin.
Yeah.
And the goblin has these rules that he has to follow. The goblin can't steal things, but they can take lost things. So they've got this realm of lost things where they live. And I tried to see if I could apply that to a more typical fantasy magical setting. So obviously monsters operating that way, but even environments and locations and character classes that have these very strict rules. And I messed with whether that could be its own thing separate from Bastionland, but then it felt like a natural fit. It felt like it could be a cool way to look at sort of the myth of this fictional world. So yeah, after that point, as soon as I sort of settled in on like the hex crawl element, that was about the point when it kind of felt like it was close to its final form. And then after that, there was just a lot of fine tuning rather than lots of big sweeping changes.
And so what's the bestiary like of Mythic Bastion? What are like the kinds of creatures that our knights could encounter?
So I think with Into the Odd and Electric Bastion, and I've always wanted to avoid making things too obviously based on D&D monsters. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I'm not going to have dragons. I'm not going to have owlbears. I'm not going to have trolls. But for this, there's lots of your classic kind of folklore monsters, but I've still tried to make it feel more like the kind of the folklore idea of a goblin and what that could mean in this world, rather than just how can I make a D&D goblin. There's lots of different types of undead and ghosty things. You've got lots of mundane things. One of the myths is the river.
That one is so cool.
And in fact, the first one in the book is the plague, and there's kind of nothing magical about this. It's just a plague, and the omens are just the plague getting worse and how people are reacting to it. I've not been able to have a dragon. There actually isn't one myth called the dragon, but there's about four that are clearly different types of dragons. So there is like the wyvern, which is the medieval poisonous dragon taken to an extreme, and then there's one he's called the serpent, which is like the fiery dragon taken to its extreme. It's been a lot of fun to indulge in those kind of old favorites, if you like. Yeah.
And listen, how do you write physically? Like, do you take notes, write at night, at day, on a computer or on a notebook?
So I'm very fortunate in that now I've been working full-time on RPGs for 4 years now, actually. It was my four-year anniversary last week.
Congrats. That's so cool.
Going full-time. Congrats. And I'm very fortunate to be able to do that, I realize. And I think it's really interesting looking back, because when I wrote Electric Bastionland, I was still working my day job at the time. So I would just try and squeeze writing in wherever I could. Like literally, if I had a 5 minute break at work, I would sneak in some writing. And if I do that, the kind of the writing comes quite easily. But if I sit down at a computer at 9 o'clock in the morning with a coffee and be like, right, today I'm going to write 20 nights, that just doesn't work for me. So I have to kind of trick myself into this kind of short burst, intense writing. So I pretend I've got 10 minutes and now I'm just going to try and write like a 2-word summary. It might just be like a cool phrase, just trying to think of like an evocative idea. And then later when you go back to that page, it's no longer a terrifying blank page. You've got kind of the scaffolding in place almost. And then you just have to go in and write. Yeah, that kind of two-step process was used a lot in this, especially for the knights and the myth.
A nerd question. How many pages can we expect in the book?
Because 220, I think. Let me check. 207. Including the index.
And would you like to mention the rest of the team? Because the book looks really gorgeous. Who has been doing what in the book?
So it's a very small team. I've done the layout and all of the writing. Mm-hmm. And Alex Sorensen, who did the artwork for Electric Bastionland, has returned to do all of the art and the border and the cover. And if it looks nice, he's made it.
Okay.
I knew going in I was going to like his work for this, but we spent quite a long time nailing the look down. And now every piece that he sends me, I'm blown away by like the detail he's managed to get in there. And just the tone of it all is just perfect for what we were going for. So yeah, myself, Alex Sorensen, and that's about it. I'm publishing it myself.
Yeah.
It's a really simple team for this one.
And like the art is really gorgeous. It's really different from the art in Electric Bastionland. There's a very limited color palette with mostly cold colors and a few warmer spots of colors. And it's kind of reminiscent of what I would associate with old fairy tale books, but with a different, darker twist.
Yeah, we wanted to kind of capture a little bit like a tapestry, and maybe a little bit like a stained glass window almost. And we went over a few different ideas. And the way that we ended was the myths all have this very natural palette, sort of almost like muted kind of greens. Yeah. And a little bit of blue almost, because the myths kind of represent the world and they're kind of the natural order, if you like. And then the seers, because they're kind of unnatural, they always have like a spot color introduced. So a particular seer might have like a bright red as their spot color, and they don't have those natural tones that are in the myths. So the seers and the myths are kind of two sides of the coin, if you like. And then for the knight piece, the knight can use the myth palette and the seer palette combined. Yes. So you've got the knights kind of existing in this kind of, they're caught between these two things, if you like. Yeah. When we came up with that, I thought, is this going to work? Is this going to just be a bit high concept and pretentious? But I think it works really well in the kind of the final
thing. No, it works very well. It has very strong immersive effects. Like the mood of the game, the world of the game. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Did an amazing job there. And listen, we spoke last time, that was like 3 years ago. I was wondering, has the indie RPG scene changed like in those 3 years? And if yes, what's different from 3 years ago?
It's difficult for me to say this objectively, but I think from my perspective, and I don't know if this is just because I've moved into making RPGs as my full-time job, but I feel like I'm seeing more people are able to do that. I think before I took the jump into doing this full-time after the Electric Bastionland Kickstarter, it seemed like something that couldn't be done. I thought, well, this is just going to be a hobby for me, and maybe if I'm lucky, it'll be something I can get a little bit of extra paid work doing this, but it's not going to be something I could possibly do as a career. And it seems like over the last 4 years, I've seen more and more people who I know who write games sort of come to me and say, oh, hey, I'm going to go full time starting from next month, or I'm working a part time job and I'm making this into my main sort of career. And I don't know whether the numbers back that up, but it feels like a lot of the really creative RPG people that I see working are more able to make a real go of it than perhaps they used to. There's a lot of really cool opportunities out there for people who are making really cool stuff.
Yeah, I have the same feeling, and I like my wild guess would be maybe more people playing indie RPGs, maybe a wider audience of indie RPG players and GMs probably. And listen, what can we expect for next from you? Like, do you have plans to extend into the other Electric Bastionland, Mythic Bastionland? Like, family, are we going to travel to the stars at some point? Because I remember
that was the last thing we spoke about. Yeah, I remember
that. You mentioned that. So yeah, what are your plans?
Believe it or not, that idea is still with me, of doing something. I do want to explore this sort of, not quite a gap, but this bit of the setting that I've never gone into really, which is the idea of the living stars. Mm-hmm. And if I do that, it would be along the same lines of Mythic Bastionland, where it doesn't have to fit 100% with Electric Bastionland. So it wouldn't be like an Electric Bastionland supplement. But I'm messing with a few ideas for like maybe a sci-fi game that would sit alongside these two as another sort of member of this family in a way that would still have links that you can pull them all together. But that's all still very much in the earlier idea stage.
Okay, no problem. We'll wait. I'm sold, by the way. So that's super exciting. Listen, where people can find you and your work online? What's the best place? You're publishing Mythic Bastionland. What's the best place to both find the game and follow your work?
If you go to bastionland.com, that's my blog, but it's also got links down the side to all of my Discord server and Patreon and podcast videos, everything that you could possibly dream of. And if you're interested in Mythic Bastionland, I'm taking pre-orders for release later this year. And there's a link to that if you go to bastianand.com and click on Mythic Bastianand in the sidebar. And yeah, that's me.
Yeah, and I'll add all those links in the show notes. Chris, thanks for coming back on the show. I had a blast chatting about your extraordinary game. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. You listen to the Lost Bay podcast, a show about and with indie tabletop RPG creators and artists. It's produced by me, Iko. Editing is by Laura L.A. Music is by Avery Eyes. If you like the show, be sure to give it a follow on your fave podcasting application. And by the way, if you're interested in Chris McDowell's work, check the interview we did 3 years ago about his game Electric Bastionland. I'll put all the links to Chris's website and Patreon in the show notes. The Lost Bay RPG Kickstarter is still live, and there is even a preview PDF on the Kickstarter page. You'll find it at thelostbayrpg.com. That's all I got for you today. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well.